This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 18th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian Tobias. Now, today I'm joined down the line by Tim Robey, film critic for the Daily Telegraph, who's attending this year's Toronto Film Festival. He'll be talking me through some of the highlights of what he's seen so far, including two films that deal with true stories set in American newsrooms, Tom McCarthy's Spotlight, and James Vanderbilt's Truth. We'll also head to Northern Scotland for Sunset Song, and we'll put our spotlight on Michael Moore's latest documentary, Where to Invade Next. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Tim. Now, before we delve into the films you've been watching, Toronto is my favourite festival. I love how it takes over the whole city. It's really now has a reputation for being second after Cannes. Does the Toronto Film Festival live up to this reputation?
I think it often does. I always have a great time. There's an enormous, overwhelming amount of films that they screen here. And sometimes you'll be here when, and you'll be lucky enough to get to see 12 Years a Slave, you know, for the first time in front of a huge audience or something like that. You're often waiting for the really enormous impact that these films can have. This year's edition has been a little bit more muted, I would say. There are a lot of kind of middling films that I've seen. So it hasn't actually stacked up quite as well this year against Cannes, say, where there were some excellent films. So yes, it's sort of, we're still waiting. There's a couple of days left, so who knows? But it's been sort of a slightly bumpy road so far.
Well, let's start looking at some of your picks for this week. Now, Spotlight tells the true story of a team at the Boston Globe who investigated cases of systematic child abuse by Massachusetts Catholic priests. Before we talk about that, let's have a listen to the film.
I'm hoping we can keep this between us until we all get on the same page.
Is that why we're here, to get on the same page?
We've got two stories here. A story about degenerate clergy and a story about a bunch of lawyers turning child abuse into a cottage industry. Which story do you want us to write? Because we're writing one of them.
A clip from Tom McCarthy's Spotlight. Now, having seen the trailer, it is a fabulous trailer. What about the film, Tim?
This is pretty good, yeah. It's just come here from Venice, where it got some good reviews. Most of the research that this team did, it was a special investigative research team of four called Spotlight, was done in the run-up, actually, to 9/11. So this is 2001 we're talking about. The story really broke at the beginning of 2002, and it required them to piece together a lot of information from way back. Obviously, the whole story pedophilia within the Catholic Church had been thrown over it for decades. So they're sort of digging back through all the records. You have Michael Keaton, Mark Ruffalo, and Rachel McAdams play three of the kind of principal journalists involved, and they're reporting to Liev Schreiber on the Boston Globe. I think they're all really good. It's been very kind of scrupulously put together, and it makes some sharp points about how it's not only the church who are, you know, culpable within this crisis, but actually the legal profession in a big way. Not only the lawyers defending the priests or kind of getting these claims off their back, but even the lawyers actually prosecuting them, because it became a sort of cottage industry, as the clip just said. Michael Keaton's character accusing Billy Crudup there of kind of taking a share of the damages that his clients were taking, and then just allowing the whole thing to go away, never going public with it. So finally, in this kind of instance, they did go public, and it became a huge deal.
Now, newsrooms are great canvases for cinematic drama. We think of All the President's Men. Does this film achieve it well? Will it appeal to only people working in the media, or is it successful at making great cinematic drama?
I think it's good cinematic drama. I wouldn't go so far as great. It does fall back a little bit on some of the sort of customary formulaic props that you sort of feel these types of films have to have. There's a scene where they're saying, well, I suppose we might as well come in on Monday morning after the story's broken, just in case the phones are ringing, you know, just in case anyone's calling us up. Inevitably, they turn up, and then the phones are going crazy because everyone's, you know, that sort of stuff. Those cliches are not kept at bay completely, I must say. So that's a slight area of reservation for me. I do think that it's very well acted, and I think there's a sort of dogged persistence to the information that's being gleaned all the way through, and I think Tom McCarthy's done a pretty good job with it. It's solid stuff. Yeah, perhaps it would appeal more to someone who's sort of inherently interested in that profession, as I am. But I think it will find quite a broad appreciation.
Well, Spotlight is currently touring the international film circuit and will begin to hit US and Singaporean cinemas in November before rolling out elsewhere at the beginning of next year. Now, Tim, your next pick is another take on the American media, but this time the focus is on CBS News anchor and producer Dan Rather and Mary Mapes. Truth follows their final days at the network as they broadcast controversial and unverified documents that suggested that then-President George Bush received preferential treatment to avoid fighting in the Vietnam War. Let's hear a short clip from this film.
You joined the army. No. General? This is Dan Rather.
General.
Sir.
Thank you for doing this. Let's start from the beginning.
And that was a clip from Truth. And in that clip, you heard Cate Blanchett and Robert Redford playing true life characters. Tim, how do they succeed in this?
Well, I think this is a rather thornier piece of work, this film. It's not at all perfect. There are things wrong with it. In fact, you could almost say there's more wrong with it than there is with Spotlight. The music, for instance, that you heard in that clip, I think, comes on very, very strong. And there are a few other problems. But I do think it's grappling with some interesting stuff, because it's grappling with the means of putting together a news story and also the purpose of it. So it's like, ticking every possible box of verification when you're really certain that what you're putting forward is the truth, is that, in fact, the whole point of news yet? You have to have it completely 100% down. And Cate Blanchett's character kind of thinks she has it, but she's only kind of got it 90% down, and it's very much her movie. Robert Redford is sort of very, very kind of dignified in his supporting role, but it's very much Cate Blanchett's film. As Mary Mapes, the producer who first came to 60 Minutes with the idea for this story, and she jumps ahead of herself. You know, she gets so excited about the ramifications of Bush's dodgy war record that she takes these memos on board, and she kind of takes them as read, and she slightly kind of rides over the reservations of the document examiners about their veracity, and then, you know, she's caught with egg on her face, really. So it becomes the story of a sort of professional disgrace, which we might view as unfair, and certainly I'm sure she viewed it as unfair. The film, I think, takes her side in the sense that Cate Blanchett is playing the role, and it's quite hard not to sort of feel that Cate Blanchett must be the one who's right about everything. she's such an intelligent actress that you sort of feel as though anyone who's standing up to her is eventually going to be, talked down. So that's all very interesting. I think that she is the absolute center of this movie, which could have just been a TV movie, but it's a TV movie starring Cate Blanchett at her best. And the kind of neurosis that creeps into her performance is really interesting, and there's all sorts of layers to it. I think the whole ensemble is actually very good. There's some very good actors lower down the cast order as well. Stacey Keach as one of the main informers they've got, and the actress playing his wife, and Elizabeth Moss is in it and gets rather sidelined. I think perhaps her role suffered in the edit and got cut out because it feels like she's not really there for any good reason.
Now, this is James Vanderbilt's directorial debut. What about visually? How does it work on the screen?
I think it's rather well shot, actually. There's some good and rather witty shots. There's an excellent moment late on in the film where we're hearing George W. Bush's second term inaugural speech, and it's on the TV in the background. And in the foreground, we see a wine glass, which Cate Blanchett's character is topping up and topping up some more and topping up right to the brim. And it's a very funny shot. It kind of brought the house down when I saw it at the Garda. Probably the standout little moment visually in the film. But I think as a debut, I think it's very proficient. A few mistakes with the music. At the end, it feels as though we're being told we've learned things, and I'd rather it had left it just a little bit more ambiguous, because it's asking some very interesting questions about bias, really, about, because obviously Mary Mapes' character is presented as a liberal, so she's got a little bit of an axe to grind, as certainly her kind of enemies would see it. On the other hand, CBS is owned by Viacom, and Bush helped Viacom enormously with monopoly laws and things, so it's almost in their interest to make the story go away. So she's battling her paymasters, and the question is, you know, these biases actually damage the journalistic profession every day. Any question that you've been kind of, you know, you've come in there with an axe to grind, or that your, you know, your objectivity is suspect, is going to really lead to a skewed news agenda. And I feel as though the film is grappling quite well with it being skewed from both ends.
Interesting. Well, next on our list is a very different film. It's Sunset Song. Here we're going back to the early 20th century and over to Scotland for Terence Davis' adaptation of the novel of the same name by Lewis Grassic Gibbons. Now, we don't have a trailer of this film, so fill us in, Tim.
Now, this is a film that Terence Davis has been trying to get off the ground for a long, long time. After he made House of Mirth, he had a script, this is back in 2000, he had a script ready to go. The financing fell through and he became very despondent and really backed away from filmmaking for a few years because he just felt it was an impossible hill to climb. He's finally got it on, you know, up on the screen, and I really hoped that he'd pulled it off, that it would be, you know, the kind of great, very, very sad First World War masterpiece that he'd envisioned. It's not, I'm afraid. I think there are lovely things about it, and the middle part of the film is beautiful. It's the love story, I think, comes to life very nicely. But for the first hour, we're dealing with the upbringing of the character played by Agnes Dean. She's got this kind of horrible patriarch of a father, played by Peter Mullen. And Peter Mullen has played so many horrible patriarchs that it's sort of hard to find anything surprising in that bit of casting. It's a bit of a slog, that first section. Then it does come to life because the guy, Kevin Guthrie, his name is, the actor playing her husband to be. Really, I think Terence Davis has made a lovely find there. It's a great bit of casting from the moment he arrives. I think he pulls you into the story, and he improves her performance too. They both become very touching together on screen. But then the film falters again at the end and makes some structural decisions that don't quite work. It looks wonderful. It looks fantastic. I think Terence Davis knows exactly how to shoot, you know, cornfields in the magic hour sunset. And he knows how to kind of go through the seasons and give us a sense of the landscape changing but not changing. And there's all sorts of great stuff in it, but I just feel as though dramatically it lacks something.
Terence Davies, he loves to reference or he adores his Hollywood films of old and very much women in roles of heroes almost. How do the women sort of shine or not in this film?
Yeah, I mean, Agnes Dean, the former model who's now kind of stepping into acting, is certainly given the big opportunity here. She's in almost every scene. And I think she is a gorgeous creature to look at, and the film gets a lot out of her face. I feel as though when she's really put to the test in big dramatic scenes, it doesn't work so well. She does a very credible Scottish accent, and I think she's working very hard, but there's just something about the part is just too big for her to manage at the end. So I think from the point of view of the story told from this heroine's angle, it's not ideal. I mean, the film it reminded me of most actually is not an old Hollywood film. It's actually a film from the 70s. It's Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. Mm. It has the same kind of feel of these people within the landscape, and they're sort of both trapped within the landscape, and also, yeah, they can't escape it, but they're trying to. I think, you know, you can see that influence in many of the shots, kind of coming up through the sweeping corn, all that kind of thing. So that, you know, that works nicely. Yeah, and some of the other performances are okay, but I think, like I say, Kevin Guthrie is the one who comes good in it. He was in that film Sunshine on Leith, the Proclaimers musical, and I think he's got a lot of talent.
Well, we're going to finish things off with a documentary, and one I expect several fans will be looking out for. Where to Invade Next is the latest offering from Michael Moore, known for Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11. Now, what is Moore investigating here, Tim?
Well, it's interesting that Michael Moore has made far fewer films of late, and one wonders if it's because, you know, the end of the Bush era left him without his great kind of Goliath to combat. You know, under Obama, is he a less purposeful filmmaker? And it's interesting that in this film, he's not spending it on American soil. He's moving abroad to make his points. You think from the title, Where to Invade Next, that he's going to be dealing with foreign policy, and he sort of tricks you into thinking that for a couple of minutes. He goes into the Pentagon at the start. But actually the idea is that he is presenting himself, Michael Moore, as a sort of an invasionary force of one. And he's turning up in various countries in Europe and planting a flag in the soil and saying, right, what have you guys got that we might want? What have you got culturally and in your society that might improve America? So the first place he goes to is Italy, where he finds out about the extraordinary paid leave and the union rights and all kinds of working advantages that Italian people have, and compares very unfavorably with America, where there's no statutory maternity leave and all these other things. Then quickly he's off to France. In France he goes to the school canteens, where, you know, kids are served four-course meals that are as good as anything you'd get in many kind of major American restaurants. And then he obviously shows them photos of the of a typical American canteen lunch, and the French school children recoil in horror. And that's the sort of idea. So we're picking and choosing all the most advantageous elements of various European societies and sort of trying to build a perfect America or a fantasy of one out of that.
As a Canadian, I always remember this scene in, I think it was Bowling for Columbine, where he goes and tries to open a door of a Canadian household and finds it unlocked, and then presumes that no Canadians ever lock their doors. And, you know, as a Torontonian who always locked my door, I thought this was kind of outrageous and a stereotype. And do you think, you know, he can be a bit misleading and simplistic when he discovers one thing and then washes a whole nation with it?
He absolutely can, yeah. I mean, it's very much stepping on from that moment in Bowling for Columbine, and from actually Sicko, his 2007 film about health, where he went to the UK and kind of presents the NHS as this wonderful rosy wonderland, where, you know, everything's for free. And in this one, I mean, he has sort of a justification for it in a sense, in that he's not purporting to look at the whole picture of each country. So he doesn't mention, you know, the unemployment crisis in France or the, you know, the horrendous levels of corruption and institutional misogyny in Italy, for instance. You know, none of that is part of the game, because the game he's playing is like, well, I'll pick this from here and I'll pick this from here and I'll pick this from here, and all of these will separately reveal the limitations of American politics and American governance. So it's sort of not necessary, and it's almost part of the film's fun in a way, that he's kind of overdoing it. He's kind of presenting the grass as so much greener everywhere else. He goes to Slovenia and he says Slovenia is a magical fairyland, and, you know, he kind of images of Disney castles essentially pop on the screen. So it's all in kind of a spirit of jest, in a sense, and he is using it to make serious points about American problems.
Well, it will be interesting to follow the reaction and the reviews to Where to Invade Next. Have you discovered anything else particularly special at this year's Toronto Film Festival?
I did really like High Rise, which is Ben Wheatley's film of the 1975 J.G. Ballard novel, another book that filmmakers have tried to adapt many times and failed. And I think Wheatley, who's the guy who made Kill List and Sightseers and A Field in England, has done quite an immaculate job imagining exactly what J.G. Ballard's vision in 1975 was for that novel. It's very much a 70s vision of dystopia. You have 70s wallpaper and 70s haircuts, but we're in a kind of science fictional enclave in a skyscraper, which has been built by Jeremy Irons' character. And Tom Hiddleston plays a young doctor who moves in, and gradually everything just slides into chaos. I think it's been dazzlingly put on screen. I think there's some brilliant work in the design. There's some great performances, and Jeremy Irons is as good as he's been in years. There are doubts, though, about what this film means now. You know, there's a sort of problem of relevance to it, I think. It's sort of like a museum exhibit version of that book, and sort of perfect in its way. But what is it saying to us now? And I think that's a question that a lot of people will struggle to answer once they've seen it.
Well, Tim Robey, thank you so much for sharing with us your highlights so far from the Toronto Film Festival. And I hope there's some good films still to come for you. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeVias. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday for our pick of the week's art exhibitions. But for now, thank you very much for listening.